Is it time for a mind shift? If you don't know what that means, then join your host, Dr. Clint Haycock, a former evangelical Christian pastor and Bible college teacher of over 20 years, along the journey of deconstruction and reconstruction of faith, life, religion, and spirituality.
A few years ago, I had the privilege of interviewing David Madison, who's a former pastor and now atheist, and he told me then that I should talk to John Loftus, and it's only taken 2 years, but I finally got a hold of John, so thank you, John, for being a guest on the show.
Well, thanks for having me. I'm glad you interviewed David. He's wonderful. He's amazing. I like that.
He's a good friend, and I see that he writes a lot on your blog, so I get his emails every week about he's kind of a... He's a bit of a bulldog, I guess, in some ways.
Oh, yes.
He is. But yeah, we had a good connection there, and he said, you need to talk to John, so maybe we could start. I know we're going to get into your book, The Case Against Miracles, but can you give the listeners a little bit of background, just a short sort of thumbnail sketch? Tell us about yourself.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I was like a born-again Christian type of a person here in Fort Wayne, Indiana, after being raised as a Catholic. And it changed my life, you know, because I think faith can change someone's life once that they have faith that something is true and it's important. You know, they can do a lot of things, but it's the faith that does it, not anything else. And I pursued some education because once I had my faith, I wanted to be able to understand it. It's Anselm, St. Anselm. He said that, you know, faith seeks understanding. So I sought understanding. You know, it's not the other way around. It's not, well, understanding leads to faith. But with the power of faith itself, the faith in faith, if you will, trying to understand it, I went on to, you know, get a college degree and then a couple, three master's degrees, one under William Lane Craig in philosophy, theology, philosophy of religion. And then I went on to Marquette University to get a PhD in theology and ethics. I didn't get that. My dad got cancer, so I wanted to be with him during his last few months, and I never went back. I have the same education that the former president of the Evangelical Philosophical Association had. His name is Paul Copan. He's no longer the president, but I have basically the same education as he does. And, you know, after what I consider a fairly good education, I had doubts, and I had the ability to research into my doubts, the things I should have been asking all along. And upon doing so, I couldn't believe anymore. And then after a few years of unbelief, I decided to start writing about it, and I haven't stopped. I started writing about it in about 2005, something like that. My first book, Why I Became an Atheist, was put out in 2008, and I had revised it in 2012. But I basically had about 11 books published, you know, in about as many years.
You crank out a book a year.
Pretty much, I have.
And Stephen King. You're the atheist Stephen King. Although you're not writing 400-page books a year.
No.
I don't know how he does it.
I have he writes a lot.
He does.
I have anthologies where I got some of the best scholars to write chapters for me. I have a debate book, God or Godless. It's a thin book, and I've written about four or five of my own monographs. I don't know. I just like to write. My last book, my latest book, is called The Case Against Miracles, where you know, we look at and examine the case for miracles, and we find it wanting.
So what led you to investigate this situation of miracles? Obviously, that's something that's part and parcel of the Christian faith. I mean, I'm like you. I was a pastor myself. I got a couple of master's degrees. I finished my PhD. Luckily, I just squeaked through at the end, but I did it. I was in theology, religious studies. I taught at a Bible college, you know, so I understand where you're coming from as far as that goes. Why miracles? I mean, obviously, the resurrection is the biggest miracle of Christianity. Do you go after that, or what was your motivation to research and write this book?
You know, one thing I noticed is it hadn't been done before, not from an atheist perspective. There are Christian volumes that take a look at it, lots of them, and there are a few anthologies that take a look at it, but I didn't like their conclusions. And
you'd say somewhat pro miracles.
Yeah, well, you know, I don't think that you can have a book against, I don't think you can have a book on miracles and say we're going to give equal time to the people who believe in them. I think the case is so abysmal for thinking that there have been miracles that to say, okay, now we're going to have a rebuttal to each chapter is like doing a book on Scientology and having the Scientologists give a rebuttal. No, why would you do that? Or a flat earth person? I really don't think there's any reason to believe any of the miracles that have been claimed in the Bible, the Quran, the Bhagavad Gita, bathing in the Ganges River, at Lourdes, the Catholic shrine. Now, I might be wrong. Now, don't get me wrong. I'm not saying that I'm absolutely certain about it. You know? But I just don't think that there's any reason in an educated book or class where you'd say, well, now I'm going to step aside and give equal time to someone who's going to argue on behalf of the virgin birth. Sorry, I just won't do that. That's not even reasonable. See, so it hadn't been done from this perspective before, and I wanted to do that.
So does your book, is it exclusively focused on Christian miracles? You mentioned the Ganges and other faiths, other religions. Do you take aim at them as well?
I should have. I just don't know who to ask to write those chapters. I mean, I can't just get anybody. You know, I wish I could have. But the book, as it stands, is already 560 pages. So I would have to, make some choices about what to include and what not to include at that point. And I think that you couldn't do religion itself in a comprehensive manner because you'd be leaving out so much. So I did focus mainly on the Bible, you know, Christian, the Judeo, miracle claims in the Bible, and whatever the Muslim believes of the Bible. So since the Bible seems to be common ground to the three great monotheistic religions, then by looking at the Bible and the theologies that have been derived from it, I think that should give everybody a start on how to continue to evaluate further miracles.
At least think critically about it, maybe ask some questions. Seems to me, thinking about church history, that the last time that miracles even came up as a question of doubt was, I would say, probably back in the liberal fundamentalist debates around about the turn of the century. Because I remember talking about this in old church history classes, that the liberals were denying the miracles of the Bible. They were saying, well, everything can be explained rationally, everything can be explained scientifically. And of course, the fundamentalists went the other route and they said, no, they're all absolutely true. They happen. They're verifiable, blah, blah, blah. Is that kind of the last thing you can sort of point to and say, yeah, that's maybe the last time the question even came up before you wrote your book? Well,
no. Spinoza was probably the first to offer a modern critique of miracles. And after him, Thomas Paine, David Hume, and David Friedrich Strauss. He wrote a magisterial book. And I think it came out in different editions, 1830, something like that. It's huge. I have a copy of it. I have not read it. It's just too big. But it's looking at the New Testament, life of Jesus, as if the miracles were myths. I mean, non-historical myths. And he got his perspective from Friedrich Schleiermacher, who got his perspective from David Hume. And David Hume gathered together a lot of the ideas that he had been seeing out there and put together a classic text against miracles. Something like about 1774, 1776, he had a couple editions of his book, The Inquiry Concerning Human Understanding, where chapter 10 is where he dealt with miracles. So it goes back there, and the debate has been raging since. The fundamentalist liberal debate came to that to a head, I think, in America. I think Americans are the last ones.
That's a culture war.
Hey, you know what? There are people who don't believe in miracles, and I think it's about time we debate them.
Yeah, this has been going on since the 18th century. It's an Enlightenment thing, isn't it? I mean, they're questioning everything, the veracity of the Bible and the historical records and higher criticism and all the other stuff. So why not throw miracles in there, too? So it's not a new thing, not a thing that goes back 100 years. You're saying it goes back at least to the 18th century that we know of.
Yeah, yeah. This isn't a book of history, like a historical tracing of miracles and how they were received. So I wouldn't know any further beyond that. But I would think that, you know, in every age and era, there have been people who have been skeptical of miracle claims, especially the other guys' miracle claims.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that's the important point, you know. I would gather that the prophets of Baal back in the Old Testament days had trouble with Elijah and Elisha, and they were each denying each other's miracle claims. So, you know, I'm pretty sure that the skepticism towards miracles have gone back for however long we've been in existence. It's just that we hypocritically apply different standards to the other guy's miracles than our own.
That's right. It's all a fraud when it's the other guy's religion, but when it's our religion, it's all true. What is it about miracles, though, specifically? I mean, obviously, we could point to the New Testament and say, yes, the resurrection, that's really the central core doctrine around which Christianity rises or falls, isn't it? I mean, if you take away the resurrection from a historical sort of apologetics point of view, Christianity itself falls apart, doesn't it?
Even the Apostle Paul said that.
Yeah, exactly. It's a premise. Right. Yeah, years ago, reading a book, it's called A Skeleton in God's Closet, and it's a sort of a historical fiction, and it's a story about these guys who claim to have found the body of Jesus buried somewhere outside Jerusalem. And it proves the point that if that were the case, then all of Christianity would fall apart. And that's what I, as a Christian back then, when I was an evangelical, that's what I took away. I thought, my God, the resurrection is central to the claims of Christianity. But if you take away the miracles, what are you left with? Is that really the thesis of your book?
Well, it's not just the resurrection. It's the miracles themselves. We have chapters on methodology. That is, how do you properly assess a miracle claim? We have, I wrote a chapter on evidence, and the title of it is Extraordinary Claims Demand Extra Evidence, Extraordinary Evidence. And so evidentiary things, how to properly evaluate one claim when you hear it. And we have a part two section on prophecy and miracles. And we conclude that a lot of the prophecy in the Old Testament as interpreted in the New Testament is faked. It just doesn't stand up to a good sound hermeneutic. The Psalms, for instance, were not regarded as prophecy. They were, devotional prayers and sometimes denunciations of their enemies and, a cry to God for help. But to interpret them as if they're making prophecy is historically inaccurate. And to apply them, like Psalm 22 and 69 and 118 to Jesus and his ministry, his death, is to just falsely interpret text. So there's no miracles in prophecy. And then we go through some of the chapters like on creation. Abby Hafer writes what I consider to be the single most important chapter on evolution. I mean, if you wanted to condense all the evidence, the important evidence down into one chapter, she did it. And we have an Old Testament scholar who talks about, the flood story and the crossing of the Red Sea story and some of the miracles of Elijah and Elisha and what was really going on there. And he argues that it's all part of the myth and of the myths of the day. And so if you're going to accept the miracle, you have to accept the myths, temporary. So we go right through there through the incarnation, the early Christians and magic. You have to understand what magic is. Mm-hmm. Jesus put mud on somebody's eyes and he told somebody else to wash in the pool of Siloam and somebody went and touched the hem of his garment. This is all magic.
Mm-hmm.
Then I write the chapter on the resurrection.
All right. You got the big one then.
Yeah, I did.
Take aim at the biggest target.
Yeah, I did. I think it's pretty good. Michael Shermer wrote the foreword and he agreed. He thought what I wrote pretty good. So I'm pretty happy with his comment. He said that's the best analysis he'd ever read. So whether that's the case or not, I'm not claiming that it is. But
let someone else do it.
Yeah. Have anyone say something like that, much less Michael Shermer, it's just a pretty good pat on the back.
We are going to get back into the chat with John Loftus in just a minute. I hope you're enjoying this bonus episode, kind of taking a break from all my focus on Dominion theology, Christian Reconstructionism, Christian nationalism, and all those topics I've been focusing on lately to look at something different. John Loftus's book, of course, is The Case Against Miracles. And I'm thinking, too, we're going to talk about this a little bit more. We're going to get into the topic of the virgin birth and how that's really foundational in terms of Christian theology and how it relates to this issue of Christians who might be deconstructing during this time of the coronavirus outbreak. Maybe they're questioning things. Maybe things aren't adding up. So John's book, as well as his resources on his website, could be helpful in terms of someone who's questioning certain aspects of their faith. Anyway, I just wanted to take a minute to bring you up to speed as to what's coming up next. The next episode we've got dropping is with David from the Graceful Atheist podcast, kind of continuing this theme of maybe questioning, deconstructing your faith if you're a Christian or someone who's in a particular religion. And we're going to go through a lot of different aspects of what does it all look like, deconstruction as well as reconstructing your entire life, really, your identity, your community, your new tribe and all that, the journey that we have to face after leaving a religious system behind. And then after that, we're going to be getting back into this issue of Christian Reconstructionism and all that. I've got an episode coming up with Dr. Milton Gaither, who is a leading expert on the topic of homeschooling. And we got into this issue of specifically Christian homeschooling and Christian education, how it relates to the aims of Christian Reconstructionism and how it sort of lives out a Dominionist mandate. So you're not going to want to miss that episode coming up in a few weeks with Dr. Milton Gaither. Just wanted to mention, too, that when this episode drops, this bonus episode, we're having our monthly Mindshift Zoom call with therapist Laura Anderson. Tonight is the 31st of March as I'm doing this recording. We do these every month, and this is something that you get for being a supporter of this show, access to our closed Facebook group, and then we have these calls every month. And in fact, next month's call, we're going to have David, the Graceful Atheist. He's going to be our guest in June. So I'm really looking forward to getting to know David a little bit and introducing him to the members of our group. If you want more information on how to get involved in our closed group, how to support the show on Patreon, the links, as always, are in the show notes. You can always follow me on Twitter as well. Get a hold of me there at MindShift2018. And you can send me a DM, and I love to chat with people. So let me know what you think of this episode, The Case Against Miracles. Let's go back into the conversation with John Loftus and get into this topic of the virgin birth.
Well, what I would like to do is I'd like to focus on the virgin birth. Because everybody's too concerned with the resurrection. And you're right, it's the foundational miracle.
It is, yeah.
But I think the epistemological center for helping Christians understand why they should doubt their faith would be the virgin birth. And we don't have a chapter on that, but I do write about it in my chapter on the resurrection. I mean, we have just the testimony of Mary. Apparently, and it's not her testimony. We have to understand there's a distinction between testimony and secondhand testimony or third or fourth hand testimony. Mm-hmm. And what we have is Mary's secondhanded testimony as we encounter it in Luke and in Matthew's Gospels, later Gospels. Paul is the first author, then Mark. And apparently neither Paul nor Mark wanted to write about the virgin birth. It's
Slight discrepancy there.
Yeah, it's like, just like the Lord's Prayer is not mentioned in Mark, but there you have it in Matthew. Just like the I am sayings in the Gospel of John are not in Matthew, Mark, or Luke, but then John all of a sudden remembers them. So what's going on?
There's a lot of differences in the Gospels. How do you evaluate a miracle, though? That's, you know, like, let's take the virgin birth as a case study. That's a bona fide miracle if it's true. Mary's overshadowed by the Holy Spirit and, you know, blah, blah, blah. We all know this famous story, the Christmas story, that she's going to have this baby and she's going to call it Jesus and she's still a virgin. And out of that comes all the theology whereby that preserves the sinlessness of Jesus. And, you know, he's fully human and fully God. And they spin all that out in later Christian theology, don't they? But how do you evaluate that, let's say, from a modern scientific and historical point of view?
Well, I'm glad we could talk about that because I think it's a test case for Christianity because Christians don't think about it. They think about the resurrection and they've read their William Lane Craig and their Norman Geisler and they've read their J.P. Moreland and Gary Habermas and they're ready for
I read all those guys.
Yep. So, yeah, they're all gung-ho for that. But then when you talk about the virgin birth, well, we'll have to get back to you.
I didn't read that chapter.
Yeah, that's right. Because you can actually make them think.
Oh, heaven forbid.
Before you can't have that. So the first thing you have to acknowledge is that in Matthew's gospel, the gospel author says that Joseph was convinced that Mary was a virgin and gave birth to this boy, the son of God. He was convinced in a dream. It's very explicit. It says it two or three times. It was in a dream the Lord had spoken to him. And then when he woke up, see, it's very clear he was in a dream when that happened. Now, none of us ever, under any circumstances, would take a dream as evidence of anything.
That's true.
And yet, Joseph did. But it's worse than that, because the author of the Gospel of Matthew wrote it in his little gospel there. Why would he write it in his gospel unless he considered Joseph's dream as evidence?
So that's your first line, yeah.
It's really key. And so then we're supposed to believe in an extraordinary claim based on hardly any evidence at all but a dream. And that should get to the heart of why we don't accept miracles. I mean, there's no evidence. Like, there's no chastity belt that she wore that was opened on the day that she gave birth. There was no Maury Povich wasn't there to give a test, the baby test, and say that Joseph is not the baby daddy. There's every reason to think that, you know, Mary would lie if it was otherwise. What are the odds? She lied, or that she actually gave birth to a baby God?
So you
look at that, and then the only option is to say, well, it was to say that, well, that we believe it because God wrote it in the Bible. But there's no way to test that God was the author of the Bible except for looking at the miracles in it themselves. Now, this is the kind of research that Gospel of Matthew put into this story. Then how do we know that he didn't put that same kind of research into all of his stories? That is a dream by somebody somewhere.
That proves it.
It's key. It's really key to see what's going on in the Gospels, because then Luke repeats it and the church repeats it and on and on.
It's certainly been picked up. And going back to what we were talking about, the fundamentalists and the liberals, you know, one of the five fundamentals was the virgin birth. If you denied the virgin birth and the deity of and full humanity of Christ, you were not a Christian. So that's how serious they were taking it 100 plus years ago, that they said, wait a minute, you cannot deny this and still be a Christian. So from that point of view, you can see how seriously they were taking it as far as an attack on their faith.
Yeah, they're making it a litmus test because the liberals reasonably would be rejecting the virgin birth. And so, well, we're just going to throw it in there that this is part of what it means to be part of our group. And our group, we are the fundamentals. You know, we are the fundamentalists, and we accept the fundamentals.
We get to define who's in and who's out. It's a very black and white sort of thinking.
Their argument is that if there's a God of miracles, then he can do this miracle. All right, okay, we got that. You know, we've got that from the beginning. Yeah, if there's a God, he can do miracles. And if he can do miracles, he can do the virgin birth. But that's not the same thing. That's not what we're actually looking at. Because what we're looking at is the evidence for a miracle working God. I mean, they got it bass backward. They have a conclusion, and then they make arguments based on the conclusion rather than trying to find the correct conclusion based on the available evidence. Nothing is seen more clearly what they're doing than when we look at the virgin birth, I think, because that was one of the issues that led me away from the faith. I mean, the Old Testament issue was the first chapters of Genesis, of 1 through 11. I couldn't harmonize them with science or with anything else I knew. And so then that turned out to be myth for me. But in the New Testament, it was the virgin birth story. And then beyond that, I just started thinking logically about everything else.
So that's what did you in?
No, that's what freed me.
from that perspective, it didn't sink your ship. It actually freed you for going on to be a critical thinker at large, as it were, someone who's not bound by that. Well, and they would say it's faith, John. That's what it's all about. You got to believe on faith. I can remember as a preacher, as a Christian, many times having those doubts. I'm sure you did when you were an evangelical. you know, and somebody would come around and talk you down off the cliff and get you back into the game and get you going again. But eventually there came a point where you just can't do it anymore. You can't live up to these ideals, especially when you're up there trying to be the preacher and you're the expert. You've got to have all the answers. That's got to be a hard place to be.
Yeah, if you have evidence for something, it's not faith, but faith without evidence. And even Christians will say, well, faith without evidence is blind. Mm-hmm. And I would say yes, and that's all you have. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's two types of evidence, and they're not necessarily separated by a sharp line, but there's objective evidence, that's public evidence, evidence that everybody sees, like in a criminal trial, there's the gun or, you know, there's the knife or something else, or the phone call records or something. And that's, everybody knows that's the evidence, and you do have to interpret it. But on the other hand, you have testimonial evidence, and people get up on a stand and they lie.
It happens every day.
It has happened every day. The CSI program that I've watched, one of the characters say, people lie, the evidence never lies. Mm-hmm. And so, and you have misunderstandings, you have misperceptions of the evidence, mm-hmm. you know, but the evidence doesn't lie. And what we have is testimonial evidence in the Bible. In that, we only have two authors, Paul and the author of Mark. Those mm-hmm. are the key two authors. And from them is derived everything else. I mean, you don't have Peter's testimony. You don't have Pilate's. You don't have any of the Pharisees or scribes' testimony. You have a written record of what they said, but mm-hmm. that written record is by the Gospel of Mark, for instance, right?
Right. So propaganda, in a way.
You know why we know it's propaganda?
Mm-hmm.
Because I've never heard a religious debate where someone, anyone, settled every controversy with a one-liner at the end every time. Mm-hmm. That's a clear indication it's propaganda, because I did some study into the Pharisees and scribes, and I thought real hard about why rational people would do and say the kinds of things that the Pharisees and scribes are reported to say. And I concluded that they had responses to everything everything Jesus said. And it's just that they weren't recorded, you know, by the gospel writers, because they had an agenda. And so it's not being historically faithful to the conversations. It's propaganda, pure and simple. So it's what you have is testimonial evidence. So you have second, third, fourth hand testimonial evidence in the New Testament from Mark and Paul and some others, and a lot of forgeries, versus the objective evidence. You know, the objective, what the objective evidence should look like if there was a virgin birth, what the evidence should look like if there's a resurrection. And the objective evidence is overwhelmingly, you know, you don't have it. You don't have objective evidence for those claims. That's the point. Mm-hmm. You need it and you don't have it. You have testimonial evidence. And they try to gerrymander that testimonial evidence to say things that it doesn't say and make you believe things that you should never believe. But the objective evidence is not there. And what is there is against those sorts of things.
And as you point out, certainly the synoptic gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, they don't even agree with each other on some key details. And so John's completely different. One of the things I've talked about this in other podcasts, one of the things I used to have my students do when I was teaching New Testament was compare parallel passages between Matthew, Mark, and Luke and note the similarities as well as the fairly stark differences and just make a list of the differences. And then I would ask them, okay, there's some pretty clear differences between these three. Which one are you going to go with then? Because some of them flatly contradict the other ones. Which one is the authoritative truth? You know, what actually happened historically? And there's no answer for that, because you can't say, well, we have to go with Mark over Matthew and Luke, or Matthew over Mark and Luke. You know, you're in that trap, aren't you? A lot of it tends to be circular logic from what I've found. The Bible is the word of God because it says it's the word of God, and, you know, that kind of logic.
Right. If you were to put all of the second, third, fourth hand testimony that we find in the four Gospels, including Paul, if we were to put all that testimony on a stand, in a courtroom trial, you know, where were you when you first heard of Jesus' resurrection? What were you doing? Who else was with you? Was the stone rolled back or not? What did Jesus say? What did someone else say? And you had them testify one after the other, you would throw your hands up and say, I have no clue.
put the timeline together. That's what they do at CSI, don't they? We got to put a timeline together. Well, I know you got to get going, but I have one last question for you then. Who's the actual intended audience? Who would you like to be reading this book?
The educated person in the pew, the average preacher, and the college student, that audience. It doesn't mean that scholars and above aren't interested or invited to read. I think that they would, I think they would benefit. I think there's some things in there in this book that some people have just not considered, even though they're scholars, you know. I think that we did a really good job of defending David Hume, because I think some scholars all too easily try to dismiss him. I consider this volume, you know, a major defense of David Hume. But people who can't read the deplorables, Trump supporters.
Yeah. No, he doesn't read, so why should they?
The deplorables is a certain category of people.
Oh, I see.
They're not all of Trump supporters. There are Trump supporters that, you know, can read.
They read Fox News and Breitbart and, you know, InfoWars.
Yeah. So those people wouldn't be interested in reading it, and they might have some bigger words than see Spot, see Jane. Go right. Get that home. Sorry. Yeah. I probably just offended some people, but I really.
I'm sure you did.
I think Trump is the worst president we've ever had, and he's a sociopath, and I just need to say that every time I get a chance.
Well, and that's, I know we're not talking about that from your book, but the problem that I have is, as a former evangelical myself coming out of that movement, what I'm seeing in the blind, loyal evangelical base, the support for Trump, that to me is incredibly revealing about so much of what Christianity has become, certainly in America. So to me, there is a connection. People are going to be questioning their faith. It's all part and parcel of their whole worldview, which includes the political sector as well. So it is important, I think.
It should be interesting what happens, among those who survive the virus, and what their conclusions might be when they look back on this time in hindsight, and how it affects their faith. But one thing we do know is that the younger generation is leaving evangelicalism, in particular, by the droves.
That's true. They're losing that millennial generation, aren't they? The category of the nuns, isn't it? They're growing higher than any other movement in America. And what's interesting, too, is you watch the trends. Pentecostalism is the fastest growing denomination in the world, the charismatic and Pentecostals. So the Christian nationalists are trying to ally themselves with that side of the faith so they can attach themselves to the momentum. Even though, yeah, like you say, they're leaving the church in droves. So they know they're in trouble.
So I hope that my book titled The Case Against Miracles finds its way into the hands of Pentecostals.
Them too. Well, how can people find you? I know you've got to get going, but just the last question. How can they get a hold of you? What's your website, and what resources do you have on offer besides your book?
My blog, debunkingchristianity.blogspot.com, is where David Madison and I write, along with some others. And we write something every week, sometimes more. My Facebook page, David Madison's Facebook page. And, of course, you can go on Amazon and you can check out my books. I have some pretty good recommendations by some pretty important people. And I'm pretty sure that's about all you need to do to find me. I got a Wikipedia page, whatever. So, yeah.
You're out there. You're on social media. I know I found you on Twitter, and then we connected on Facebook. So it's definitely good to chat. I hope that people get a hold of your book. As you say, if they're interested in deconstructing, I'm curious to find out if this coronavirus is going to cause people to question their faith. You know, so a book like yours would certainly help them do that, wouldn't it?
Yeah, well, where's the miracles? I mean, these churches and shrines, they're all shutting down.
Exactly. The shrine at Lourdes is closed down. Now that's an oxymoron, isn't it? It should be wide open. They should be healing people in the droves.
It should be.
Yeah. Well, Benny Hinn's closed his ministry down
too,
so that doesn't make any sense.
Yeah.
Anyway, thank you so much, John. I really enjoyed chatting with you. Hope people get a hold of you and find your work.
Thanks for interviewing me. Appreciate it so much.